Thank you for joining us for the Dev Team. We're your hosts, Mark Onsman,
Jake Overall,
and Ryan Coates.
We're a group of developers and instructors here to discuss the world of software development. So whether you're brand new or an experienced developer, we're here to chat on topics that affect our lives each and every day. On this episode of the Dev Team, Jake threatens us with some ransomware. I'll dive into the new Google remote pay structure, and Ryan deep dives with remote working.
All right, so I want to kick this episode off with a word that is, quite frankly, kind of scary, and it is ransomware. And to lead right into ransomware, I have to use the word cryptovirology.
Ooh.
You've been on Wikipedia.
Absolutely, I've been on Wikipedia. So cryptovirology, or ransomware, right, is essentially when your computer gets infected with a quote-unquote virus, right? And in the world of actual like cybersecurity, there's differences between viruses and worms and things of that nature. But let's just talk what is specifically ransomware. And ransomware is essentially a piece of software that will attack a victim's computer and potentially either lock down all of their files to where they become useless to the user. And it does what's called a hashing, right? Or it encrypts all of your files with a special key that then makes it so that you can't open them. Or if you could open them, you're just going to see garbled messes of characters, right? And so this is a pretty common thing that gets delivered, and usually the attackers want you to pay in order to unlock your files. And an alternative to potentially just locking down your own files is I'm going to consume all your files. I'm going to get your personal information. And if you don't pay me, well, then I'm going to share information about you online.
Yeah, I actually saw this recently that the very first instance of kind of a quote unquote ransomware attack was actually all the way back in 1989. I don't remember the gentleman's name, and you know, for all intents and purposes, maybe we shouldn't give them notoriety. But that said, the first attack was somebody posed as an AIDS researcher and handed out a bunch of hard disks. Like, what is the actual floppy disk, the giant square kind of, I had a Commodore 64, it would have fit into it. My verbiage is eluding me.
The old 5.5 instead of the 3.5.
Yep, yep. And essentially saying...
Or the eights,
yeah.
Yeah. That said, anyway, to hand it out to a bunch of AIDS researchers at like a World Health Organization conference for AIDS. And basically, same thing, locked down all their research, encrypted it, and demanded for unencrypting it that they send, it was about just shy $200 to this random PO box in Panama. And obviously he got busted, and it was funny. And later in court, it was kind of like he swore that, oh, he was going to use the money to help fund AIDS research.
Right. Seems kind of counterproductive or counterintuitive to take money from the very people you then claim you were going to help. But, you know, ransomware, it's delivered across the internet. It's a very prevalent thing, especially in today's world. And it's one of those things where every year, month after month, in the cybersecurity sector, things are kind of getting worse, not necessarily better, just because of the content delivery platform that is the internet. And the lack of education to, you know, the average user that is now on the internet. They don't understand that just by simply opening a PDF or opening up an email or downloading and trying to look at a picture, that these different attacks can actually be encrypted and hidden within common files. And so a very famous ransomware attack was delivered in 2017. It was called the WannaCry attack. And it's an attack vector that we are still suffering from various strains of that same vulnerability today, right? And it's just one of those things where ultimately educating our end user is pretty much the best form of protection, is just purely education. And things like McAfee and your antivirus solutions, they only work so well. And that has to do with, you know, hashing algorithms and looking at different files and things of that nature. But it's just, you know, one of those things where bring a little bit of a general awareness to some of our users, and you know, be aware that not everything that you touch on the internet is safe. So remember, wash your hands.
Talking about even a recent one, the Colonial pipeline, just that was May or something this year, where basically the same thing, ransomware, and it shut down the oil pipeline. And that's what caused some of these big shortages in some of the southern states is ransomware.
Yeah. And generally, you know,
and they paid.
And that's massive companies are paying. Yeah. Massive companies are paying massive dollar amounts to these attackers. And the thing is, and generally from a cybersecurity standpoint, our number one counsel is always never pay, never pay. Because if you pay even a small amount, then they think we can get you for more. We can get you for more. We can get you for more. And then often at the end, they either won't unencrypt your files anyways, or they'll publish your information anyways. And so it's really kind of just a lose-lose if you start paying.
So my understanding was that wasn't quite the case, because if that happens too often, nobody's going to pay. And then they lose out on any avenue of attack, right? So I think the key with ransomware from a crypto virology. Yeah, that one. Is that it is the ransom is the goal. Like, because I could encrypt all your data and ask you for nothing. I could have done it just as a DOS attack, right? You can no longer service. You can no longer provide your value to the world. I've pretty much bankrupted you overnight. I've encrypted your stuff and I've gone bye, right? Like the act of actually unlocking it after you've paid, I think is a critical part of why it's successful. Because if you didn't do that, if you released it anyway, if you pulled one over, like that's going to become news pretty quickly and nobody's going to ever pay you again. This seems like a bit of a scam, right? Which
it is
to begin with.
They are. I mean, but the saying is, you know, there's no honor amongst thieves, right? And so you're gambling with either way that you go, right? Just the general advice is don't pay, especially if you're a small, if you're a large company, you know, situations may be different, right? But if you're an individual victim, it's your own personal computer, chances are you shouldn't pay. You're most likely better off to, you know, format, potentially lose those files. Because even if you accept the way to unencrypt your files, what if you're actually just accepting another backdoor into your system?
I think the other thing too, you have to look at is sometimes that pay is not even, in some of the cases I've seen, monetary. It's additional information about you or incriminating evidence. And even more so in those cases, like, no way at all. Do you want to give this person more fuel? But I have to look at the pipeline thing. And if I recall correctly, the government did not stand behind that company. Basically, they said, hey, our suggestion is just do whatever you need to do to get that oil flowing again. And it was like, great. Federal government, even further encouragement. Another one, this is what you see with the ransomware, is it becomes more of that bidding game of how low can I, where's that sweet spot of I'm taking enough money that it's worth it, but not enough that you'll just flat out say no, right? I think for this big oil company, it was like $5 million. And for them, that's not a lot. But at the same time, you know, to get it turned on and get things flowing right away, you know, how much money were they losing a day by not being able to get those pipelines working?
And I think, you know, there's a lot of companies out there where cybersecurity and things like these are an afterthought. Like paying down technical debt is not something you necessarily prioritize on versus new features, new capabilities, more profit. And this is definitely causing, I think, a wake up call to a lot of industry. Like, you know, well, I'm even gonna have to pay $5 million in ransom, or I could, you know, invest $3 million and, you know, implement some changes, pay off some debt, you know, fix some of the security vulnerabilities I've let myself, you know, develop over the time to, you know, in order to increase profit and kind of feature delivery, right? I think it's definitely causing that kind of awakening among, you know, CISOs and CTOs and stuff like that. Like, what can we do differently? How can we make it so an attack like this doesn't affect us very broadly? How can we minimize that kind of blast radius?
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of that is just having the right people in place, the right monitoring tools, actually looking at your systems. There was an attack on Sony, right? Sony is always being attacked. The most recent attack, they figured that the hackers were actually live in their system for about 7 months prior to being caught. And they siphoned out terabytes of data, terabytes. And to me, that's, you know, there's just a lack of overall security implementation in a company like that. And Mark, you kind of alluded to a little bit to the fact that, you know, the poor oil company, right? The government didn't step in and help them. It's not the responsibility of the government to tell the private companies how to manage, you know, their security firms, right? And of course, that is something that does affect all of us individually, the entire world, right? Like, we depend on oil for all sorts of different stuff. But I don't think it was the place of the government to step in anyways. So,
well, that said, both the CIA and the British equivalent both have very well documented kind of processes and procedures and things you can be following to ensure, you know, system survivability and stuff like that. You know, they have benchmarked kind of implementations of like, this is how you should use this type of system. This is how you should use this type of system. I remember back when I was doing servers, you know, we would get guides, like hardening guides from like CIA and the NSA, you know, this is how you should harden your Windows server. I'm not sure if there was hardening it in a certain way so that they could still get in. I'm not, you know, but there was still a guide. And in most firms I worked at, it was followed. It was like, this is a good benchmark of a secure system, right? And no system is, you know, I think if you think about the cybersecurity landscape these days, we talk about assume breach, yep. Right? Assume they're in, right? How do you minimize that blast radius if they're already here, right? And you talk about the Sony thing, you know, wherever they had tools and processes in place, if somebody's in and they've got that kind of time, siphoning out data when you've got that kind of time, that it's very hard to detect, right? If they started dumping terabytes out over a weekend, that's going to flag up on so many systems, it's not funny. But you sit there and go, well, as long as I don't get caught, I can spend a couple of months doing this. That's background noise, you know, in the scheme of things. And that obviously gives them much more availability to kind of capture that kind of information. You know, I think going, you know, if you can assume breach, like what would you put in place in these systems to kind of counteract that, to capture that earlier, to, you know, you see silly systems in place today, right? Password rotations. You must rotate your password every 3 months, right? Or something silly. Like I don't even think NIST requires that anymore. They say don't rotate your password unless you think it's being breached. Just make it complicated, make it easy. You know, so every time I change it, what do people do? They write it on a post-it note, they put it on their monitor and they call it good. And that's a weakness that's gameable, right? And having an 8-character password, also very gameable these days. You know, we've got machines of 100 cores in. Your 8-character password is not going to hold up under scrutiny for any amount of time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we could talk about the cybersecurity or lack of cybersecurity practices, I'm sure, for hours and hours, right? You know, and definitely there's a lot to be considered there. And, you know, you're not wrong. Like, we should be using passphrases over passwords. Or in very recent news, I guess to maybe steal this just a little bit, GitHub just over the weekend moved everyone from password authentication to personal access tokens, right? And it's a much better system in place, but there's a user training also that has to go in there, right? And when you're looking at a company like GitHub, like most of the GitHub users are developers, right? So we hope that they can figure out how to get their personal access tokens figured out. But you know, trying to do that across an enterprise, you know, company, like, it's going to be tough.
I mean, Pats come with their own downside, trust me.
Oh, they absolutely do.
Well, I'm going to take that cue and jump into news here, kind of switch away, because like you said, we will be on cybersecurity the whole episode potentially. But I did want to talk a little bit about the news, and this will eventually transition into kind of what Ryan's talking about. But a recent news article came out from Reuters, I think originally had kind of broke the story, and then several people have picked it up. But
it's pronounced Reuters.
Reuters? Oh, well, you know. You do you, I'll do me.
Are we talking about routers?
No, those things are different.
Google is actually kind of, we're in this whole, in this after times, right? In the post-COVID times, and maybe it's not even fair to say post-COVID, but regardless, you know, people are transitioning, people are changing. A lot of people are transitioning to remote. And of course, Google is seeing that more than anyone because they're such a big company. But that said, they've actually recently come out with some changes to their pay scale structure, in that if you are not in the city which you're essentially hired in, you get a pay scale adjustment if you are work from home. So, you know, they do have people who, of course, you know, San Francisco, really high and expensive pay. People live in, you know, southern of San Jose and stuff like that and commute. But some of those people have decided, you know what, I am going to work from home now. Well, those people are now facing adjustments to their pay based on the city they live in. Same thing. If I worked in San Francisco originally, I thought, you know, I'm tired of this big city life. I can work remotely fully. I'm going to move to Boise, or I'm going to move to some other smaller town where cost of living is lower and keep my San Francisco pay. Well, Google says no more of that. We're actually going to be calculating and adjusting pay based on where people live. A lot of controversy on that, obviously. In before the session, we kind of poked around on this, and you guys seemed a little have an opinion on that. So I wanted to talk about that a little bit, talk about what maybe both sides of that argument might be, and kind of see what we think.
Are you telling me people are moving from California to Boise?
I think it's a kind of a small, maybe two or three.
I hadn't seen that.
As someone who's worked remotely for the past, like, what, 15 years, something like that, Ryan, like, what's your take on this? I, for one, it makes me kind of furious, but maybe that's only my knee jerk. So,
I think my knee jerk is similar, but when I take a step back, so I work for a company that has adjustments for pay based on where you're in. Now, I don't know what those adjustments are. I don't know if I was doing my job and I was based out of New York, I don't know what that delta would be because I joined them whilst being in Boise, right? And those adjustments are generally served over time. So if I moved to, let's say I moved from I think we categorize our cities with letters. Like if I was in an A city and I moved to an E city, right? It's not like my next paycheck has like, you know, a chunk missing from it. It's more of a next time I get a pay rise or a promotion, like that won't be what it could have been because they would have to have incorporated some of that stuff into it. Right? So they don't like just slice it out from underneath you. And I think that's important. That said, at the same time, how much artificial inflation am I doing to a salary because you live in Silicon Valley and you have to pay Silicon Valley, you know, housing prices and stuff like that? I don't know, right? I don't know what that delta is or if that, like, to me, did I need that much extra just so I could live here? Like, was it like you must be in the office thing? Like, what is my comfortable salary? I have an idea of what I'm worth based on my skills, my position in the industry, what my peers are getting paid, things like that. And as long as I'm at that threshold, like if you're paying me more because I live in Austin, Texas versus Boise, like I may or may not care, like how much higher is my rent. Now, the problem is systems like that don't necessarily keep up. Like you look at Boise's market, like we talked about this a lot recently. Boise's market is exploding. I don't know of a ton of people getting, oh, you work in Boise, let's pay you more money. it's not necessarily something we're seeing. So how does that work in both directions? Like if a market becomes really popular, as people all leave Silicon Valley and let's say they all settle in Omaha, I'm not sure they will, but let's say they do. Do you start regrading Omaha and saying Omaha is now a more expensive city, cost of living has gone up, we need to pay everyone more? I feel that it's a very complicated set of calculations to do. Whereas if you just pay someone for the job they do and, you know, make that fair, then I think your competition is flat. You could go anywhere or live anywhere and get paid the same for your skill set. So, I straddle that fence a little carefully because I'm like, obviously I have team members that live all over the country, all over the world. You know, how do I provide a fair system to them and reward them for their capabilities whilst, you know, taking into the fact there's, you know, differences of, oh, you live here versus there. Like there's more hardship, but that's also kind of a choice. Like if I don't need you to be there, like Google has this attitude of we need you to be on campus. There's value to you being here. And thus we pay you a premium to be here. If you're not there, that value is gone. I no longer get that collaboration benefit. You're now working on virtual tools, which we all know are not quite as exciting as a whiteboard in a room. So they've lost potentially productivity, which they're now paying less for. If you look at it from that perspective, it doesn't seem quite as harsh.
And to call out specifically, and I, you know, I don't mean to pick on Google, they're just obviously the big name doing it, but you know, other big names, Facebook and Twitter are also in this kind of, we're going to adjust remote pay work. And one of the things that they cite specifically, and I'll let Jake kind of give his response here in general, but is kind of that idea that, like, hey, you were originally hired in, say, San Francisco, and maybe we do have a Boise site for whatever this company is. You know, it's Google, Amazon, whatever. And you were hired in San Francisco. You got the pay rate that is adjusted for cost of living in San Francisco when you started there. Somebody else started in Boise, and what they pay people in Boise is competitive for the Boise market, but it's even for the exact same job, it's less. So you move here to Boise, but you're technically still a San Francisco employee. So how is it you're in the exact same city as somebody else doing the exact same job for the exact same company, and you're making significantly more because you were originally hired in San Francisco? Now, I think there's other ways to potentially fix that, but that's kind of one of the things that it brought up, is they are adjusting based on things like that.
So I think my initial knee jerk again is it makes me furious. And to me, it kind of feels like this is a money grab. This is a way for companies to hoard even more money. And that's a major problem here, especially in the United States, is, you know, the billionaires making even more. And we're going to adjust your pay down simply by where you live. Right. And who's gets to say what the cost of living is in Boise? And I have issues with that term anyways, just the cost of living, right? Like how much of a fallacy is it to say like just our life demands a cost just to live, right? And I get kind of the concepts behind that, but I think how is it fair to have people doing the same title, same job, and have drastically different wages, right? And I understand the difference between salary ranges, right? And if a salary range for a particular job, let's say this is a Dev 3, and your average range is, you know, $100,000 to $120,000 a year, that's market standard. That's perfectly fine. Are you telling me you're now going to adjust that down to, well, you live in Boise and, or you live on the outskirts of Boise, right? Like you live in, I live in a particular county, maybe like CUNA, right? Or in a city like CUNA.
Who lives in CUNA?
Right, CUNA instead of Boise. So now you're even going to adjust me down even further, not from Boise wages, but I'm in a county. I'm 20 minutes outside that city because that's my choice. That's my commute. But you're now also going to dock me. Right? That to me seems absolutely ridiculous.
Just down. I thought you were giving Boise salary ranges. My bad.
I think that you have to play this very carefully, right? Like who gets to make that decision that this company, you know, or this particular city, you know, is a 10 or 20% deficit from the Bay Area.
So I know it is kind of, they cite it's from the U.S. Census Bureau on like average income and stuff like that. And they basically, you know, their Google's quote unquote argument is, you know, we pay top dollar for that area. Right. And so, you know, $140,000 in San Francisco, if you're living in San Francisco, is like, it's not great. Elsewhere, that's twice the income of the average person. So
and my pushback there, though, is when was the last time the census was adequately performed?
Every 10 years.
Yeah, 10 years. Like, and again, I don't want to just get like angry, but I'm going to play the,
sure.
You know, I'm going to play the, what if I was working for this particular company? I've moved to Boise, right? Or I've always lived in Boise. You hired me on originally at $100,000 a year, right? And now all of a sudden Google says, you know what? You live in Boise. We're going to dock you down, you know, $10,000. You don't need $100,000. You only need $90,000.
And I think that's one of the big call out problems that they found is even in certain cases, one of the examples was somebody who lived in more of a rural area of New York who worked in the New York office. So they would take a commuter train like an hour a day. So half an hour train ride, 45 minute train ride. And the cost of living for where they were, if they worked from home, would cut their pay, I think it was like 15%, 15 to 20% of their pay reduction for not taking that train every day.
5% of that income was on train fares.
Yeah. So.
And I agree. There's a benefit to say, hey, I'm an in-office employee, right? We are collaborating. But oftentimes companies offset that with, hey, you come to the office every day, you have access to the gym on site. You have access to all of this other stuff. You have access to free daycare. You have access to this, that, and the other, right? Like there's a lot of benefits that are given to you a lot of times when you are working on site, right? And so if I'm working remotely.
So you'll work more.
Yeah. And so yeah, absolutely. It's will. I mean, the illusion of freedom, right? Illusion of freedom comes with that illusion of pay, right? But there's that concept of saying, okay, well, I am going to work remotely. I no longer get free daycare. I have to pay for my own gym membership and you're still docking me money. Doesn't seem fair.
No, I think it's interesting that, you know, and again, I don't know if we're kind of moving too far down the realm of just remote work in general, but I think this goes both ways. Right? As the entire industry starts shifting to this kind of remote hybrid model, I think, so I've always made the joke with people. I was like, if my new job doesn't let me work remote, I'd have to leave Boise. I mean, my pay would probably drop over 50% to take a job in town, right? Now, I've never been hired as a Boise employee who just kind of worked nationally. Like I'm hired on my last couple of jobs. You're a remote employee. That's what you've been hired for. So to tell me I'm a remote employee on day one and to tell me that I have a national reach on day one, but then to say, because you live in Boise, we're going to pay you less. It's a weird conversation. But at the same time, like I said, I don't know if that's really a delta I can measure against, because if I was trying to find a job in Boise, I'd already take a huge pay cut. So I don't know. There are definitely bigger markets who can, you know, who have more roles for the type of skill level that you may or may not be at. And that's the thing though, if remote work becomes common, what's to stop all of our, you know, we've got a lot of junior and intermediate devs in the Valley here. But a lot of them hit a pay ceiling. A lot of them leave. They're like, okay, I'm going to Seattle. Okay, get paid more. Amazon's hiring like hotcakes. Bye. Right. And that's a huge jump up from the average salary in Boise. Right. So, you know, if remote work becomes more common, does that allow them to stay here close to home, close to friends, family, whatever, and still get a pay rise? Maybe it's not the 120% raise they were thinking if they'd moved to Seattle, but 100% still 100%, right? And I think people need to make that individual call, right? There's still going to be roles that are in person. There's still going to be benefits to being in person for certain positions and certain, you know, depending on what role you have. And I think, you know, as long as that's done in a transparent manner, I think is the important thing. Like if companies are like, look, this is a thing, right? This is what that delta is that delta worth it to you? Because quite frankly, I think to me, the delta would be, I'm from London and I used to commute hours every day. You know what? I don't know if I'd trade it back in again versus working from home and walking upstairs to my office. So
to kind of cap this off and kind of round out the news section before we transition fully to remote kind of conversations in the deep dive, there are companies, and I don't know whether this is in response to or just so happened to be at the same time, but Reddit and Zillow recently announced that they are moving to a location agnostic pay scale. So exactly the opposite, to say, hey, regardless of where you are in the country, this is what we pay for this role. So kind of that exact what you're talking about, Jake, where it's like, hey, here's my skills. Here's what I'm doing. It doesn't matter where I'm doing it. This is how much I get paid. And it sounds like, Ryan, that's more or less what your company does, or maybe that's just your position within the company.
No, my firm definitely has adjustments for scale. They're not super transparent. Like I don't know what I get paid less versus if I lived in San Francisco when I took the job. So it's never really been something I've worried about because they paid me enough at the time to take the job, right? But, you know, if they were to turn around, and like I said, my company doesn't, you know, if I did move, there wouldn't just be a, we're chopping your pay 10%. Like it's more of a, as you go through promotions and pay rises, like the, you know, the band is normalized. You won't maybe get what you would have got during that last round. And they might take a couple of cycles to normalize that back out. Like, again, it's not designed to hurt you. It's just designed to kind of keep things realistic. And there are lots of economical kind of reasons behind some of that. Like all of a sudden, if half the people in Boise were making, you know, San Francisco wages, what does that do to Boise's economy? There's a lot of people in Boise that aren't making San Francisco wages. And what, like we already deal with complexities like the housing boom and all this other stuff due to migrations and stuff. So what does that do if half of your earners are now raking in San Francisco salary? What does that do for the price of a loaf of bread, right?
I mean, I think we're seeing that specifically here in Boise, yeah. Right? I do want to point out though, like, and I don't remember if we talked about this on the last couple of episodes or not, but the concept of discussing your pay salary, right? Like for a long time it's been, and even to this day, most people think it's taboo to talk about how much money I make in this particular job. And the only entity that employees are protecting by not being willing to talk about their salaries is the company itself, right? And so, you know, you talk about transparency, and I think transparency is a very important thing, right? Like I know specifically, and this happens in every industry, right? My wife is a nurse. We've seen this where one nurse, RN, they have the exact same license, gets hired on, has worked for a company for 5 years, and the new hires get hired on it more than that person who's been there for 5 years. I'm training someone who is making $10,000 more than me. They're a brand new grad, but because the pay scale has gone up for the average nurse, the salary, the annual raises hasn't even remotely met that inflation, right? And so sometimes it's, you can't, unless that nurse decides to leave, like, they're not going to be making that. And they don't find out unless they're willing to discuss those salaries, right? And again, maybe I'm just trying to be, you know, devil's advocate, controversial here and anti-corporation. But, you know, those are real issues that we are faced
with.
It's
like you're an entrepreneur who started his own company or something.
Yeah, and you're not wrong. I feel like that it does start to drift probably way off topic for kind of where we're at. And so I'm going to wait, kind of transition you.
Are you censoring me, sir? Are you censoring me?
Jake, how much do you make? You're my boss, right?
I still think that, and as sad as it is, I think there's a silver lining to this. I think for a long time, we've talked about the kind of gender inequality pay, right? And you know, we've seen movement on that and probably not nearly as much as we'd like. I think the fact that you're now going to have a bunch of old white people getting their pays cut as they move around the country, I think this is going to be this is going to cause a conversation to be a lot louder. And like I said, as sad as that is, it's going to happen. People are going to be yelling and screaming from and these are people that have privilege to do it and get answers. And again, I think that could potentially be a good thing if we start talking more about location and less about, you know, whether you're a man or a woman or something in between, right? I think that's, This can only lead to good conversations, potentially, whether people are happy or not. I think, you know,
I agree. And I think that's my big push is transparency needs to be there if we're going to start going down this route.
I'll wrap up there and turn it over to Ryan.
So remote work in general, I mean, I think we just covered the important parts, right? So, yeah. So like Jake mentioned, obviously I've worked at home. I've been home-based for a long time. There was a time when I first moved to the US, I was back in an office for a while and didn't really work for me. So yeah, I mean, remote work, it's not necessary for everybody. I think most people have realized that over the last year, they've been forced into it. Some of them have found they enjoy it and that it works for them. And some of them have found it doesn't. You know, there's definitely certain personalities and folks that, like, you know, they're stuck doing it, but their productivity's dropped through the floor. And you've probably seen other people whose productivity gone through the ceiling. I think, you know, this new normal of, like, you know, remote is acceptable for a lot of different roles that it wasn't acceptable before. I think this is an interesting time. And I want to talk more about, you know, you guys, obviously the type of work you do, you have to come to an office every day. You know, I used to travel quite a lot, and not because I needed to be in an office, but more my role and what I did, it caused me to have a lot of meetings. I still have those. They're just on Zoom. Right. But there's, you know, again, I mentioned there's definitely value to being in front of a whiteboard together at times. There's certain collaboration that just doesn't really translate to the virtual world, at least not yet. The tools and the systems just aren't there. I'm sure you've all used tools like Miro and Mural and Lucid Spark and stuff. You know, there's tools out there that kind of help us kind of swarm on a whiteboard, but it's not the same. And it's not as quick as easy. And it's like, you know, as folks that have to work in an office for the type of work you do, like, where do you see this balance? Like, how did you deal when you had to teach remotely over Zoom?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, our work is very unique in that as teachers, kind of how we interact with people. And I would say, you know, because I more so than Jake taught classes on Zoom, and it was really, really challenging and really tough. I'd felt isolated, and I'm a different person too. I'm a very social person. I enjoy interacting with people and kind of that type of thing. So I will speak to myself. I struggled. I also like to, you know, I don't know if you know this, I like to make jokes, little puns and things like that. And it's really hard.
Do you ever make funny ones?
No. But that said, it did feel that way because everyone's on mute. Everyone's cameras were off, and you'd make a joke and it's just silence and okay, I'm just going to move on. And it was very much isolating. It was very lonely in a sense that, you know, I talked to people every day and I talked more at people into my computer every day. But the other big part of teaching is there's a big part of kind of reading the room. How are people expressing? How are they emoting? Do they seem awake? Is it time to take a break? Things like that can be very, very challenging. So from the teaching side of the house, I would say I struggled quite a bit. Dev side, not as much.
No, I felt the same. Obviously, I kind of present to most of your graduating classes. And I remember there was a couple of windows there where it was virtual only. And it was, yeah, like you said, everyone's on mute. You know, I'm pretty interactive with my talk specifically is kind of interactive. And so trying to figure that out to do virtually and get that feedback and get the engagement, it was a very different beast. And it definitely was kind of off-putting the first couple of times. I don't really know, like, I can't read the room. I can't get a vibe for if people are getting this, if they're enjoying it, if they want to move on. You know, it's definitely something that you've got to get used to. And again, you know, there's a lot of tools and capabilities and systems you can get to help. Like, if you looked at my home studio right now, you'd be like, where do you work, Ryan? NBC, right? It's, you know, but I don't necessarily use that on a daily basis, but when I'm doing a keynote or something, it's, you know, it's important to be able to see what's going on and get as much feedback as I can. And I have different ways of doing that now because I can't just look out there at the audience and feel what they're feeling, right? You know, and especially when you're trying to tell stories and stuff like that, like, you know, getting that hook in is an important kind of part of the process. Like, yeah, are they hooked? Are they engaged? Have you kind of captured them? And then you can move forward. So if you haven't, it's probably not much point moving forward because it won't make a ton of sense. So
I think, and, you know, maybe this is the psychosocial concepts of just humans, right? But we've gathered, right? Gathering together as humans is something that we have always done. And so I think, you know, to speak to the concepts of remote versus in person, when I first launched the Boise CodeWorks website, I remember one of the paragraphs I remember writing in it was, there's no substitute for face-to-face education, right? And they're really, I truthfully believe that. We can get close. We can get, you know, there's tools out there that allow us to still present those concepts. We can still teach, you know, and the education can still be wrought, but not nearly as effectively in the same amount of time or to the same degree of effectiveness. And, you know, like you said, maybe eventually technology will catch up. But there's something about just being in the same room with another person or another group of people it's conductive, right? It's almost, I don't know if there's actually physiologically anything that's happening, but I am a big believer that absolutely face-to-face will outweigh online and be, you know, online anytime. But that being said, you know, that's not the only way to get work done. It's just a very effective way to get work done.
And to kind of build from where I was going in kind of that direction is from the teaching side and the things that I have to do that were social, it hurt and it struggled and it wasn't as good as maybe I would have wanted. But I feel like from the development side and things when it was, hey, I'm focusing on my task, I'm building this specific app, I'm writing code or at certain times writing curriculum for that matter. But I felt like that was potentially more productive because you don't have those distractions, or at least I didn't. I didn't have, you know, people come and ask me questions or breaks or things like that. I was able to kind of just sit down and focus a little bit more. And so I concentrated the amount of work that would have normally taken me longer on a development type task, and it was done much faster. So I think that there's not a, it's kind of a, it depends on what you do. It depends on what type of focus that stuff requires. Because quite frankly, I feel like development did go a little bit easier.
Yeah, I think, you know, and let's be fair, remote work for the majority of us who've done remote work before and will continue doing remote work is not the same as what everybody did last year. Okay, being at home and having everybody at home with you, this is not the same thing, right? Having to have your kids off on one set of iPads doing their classroom stuff and you in another room sitting in a dining table chair, like doing your work while the wife's over there on her call, trying to not to carry over to your mic. This is not normal remote work, right? What we all went through last year, and I say we is the royal we, I live alone and have done for a while, so it didn't really change for me. But for those of you who have families and stuff who are all also at home, this is not the experience that, you know, we talk about increased productivity or decreased productivity. I cannot imagine anyone who had to be tech support for their kids and, you know, also still prepping lunches and going shopping and doing all the things you have to do and now doing it all while everyone's at home. I can't imagine that was or felt super productive. I think the general consensus is that people did maintain productivity, potentially at the expense of their mental health, right? I think we're all feeling that this year. But that's not, you know, for those of you who experienced working from home the first time last year, that is not what working from home is. Like to Mark's point, you know, if I want to put my head down and get some stuff done, that's cool. I take my headphones off and I'm not on a call anymore and I just get some stuff done. There's nobody bugging me. There's no outside influence. There's no one coming up to my chair and going, hey, Ryan, can I grab you for a few minutes? It's like, it doesn't happen. But, you know, to my point about how often I used to travel, there's definitely roles and types of work that do benefit from, you know, teaching is probably a good, great example, that you all need to be in the same place. And I think this hybrid model that most places are thinking about, I think that makes a ton of sense. I think, you know, hey, you can work from home when it's convenient, when it works for you. We do have some times we want you to be in every month because we're getting everybody in because we're going to do certain things, you know, call them ceremonies if you know what I'm talking about. But, you know, there are certain things we get value from us all being in the same place, right? And you know, as someone whose whole team is remote, that caused a lot of us to travel a lot, right? It's like we're off in Nashville every couple of weeks or wherever, you know, just so we can get around a table, get around a whiteboard and hash some stuff out. And then we go off back and we're solving problems ourselves again, right? We're back to developing or working on our own tasks that came out of that kind of meet. And so I think that's really where it's going. But you know, I think, you know, from a working remotely thing, you have to find what works for you, right? And that goes down even to the chair you sit in. Like, you know, last year you might all been fighting over the four dining room chairs and you might have hated it. And you're like, why do people work from home? Like, you know, that's not a thing. Like if you're gonna choose to work from home, spend the money, like buy yourself decent equipment, set yourself up for success, right? Don't sit there suffering through in agony in a hardback chair, you know, with a dining table that's 3 inches too low for your laptop and trying to be as productive. You won't be. And ultimately you're going to hurt yourself.
I think, you know, that experience that people had, you know, not having the right equipment was due to dire emergency, right? If a company is going to elect and make the decision that we are now having remote employees, I think it's the responsibility of the company to, you know, have a particular, you know, home office budget. Right. If I was working from the office every day, I would come in, you would provide my chair. Right. at least some of those basic necessities, right? And that becomes a little bit more difficult to say, hey, we're going to ship everyone this exact same desk. That's not a thing, right? But allowing some sort of extra stipend or, you know, bonus annually to make sure that you have up-to-date office equipment is an absolute crucial thing. And I think it is the responsibility of the company to provide at least, somewhat of a budget for allowing that for remote employees.
I think kind of lastly in that home office thing that you're seeing a lot with remote work, and obviously we haven't really even talked about this, but, and this almost even comes back to the salary thing, but those nomadic workers, people who are like, oh, I'm actually going to work from my mobile home or I'm going to work from, you know, so I just take my, I just drive around and I have maybe a satellite internet or something like that, that, you know, I'm not having to worry about internet at any given time. And yeah, I just travel the roads. And I think that that's another kind of unique context. One of the things I heard that actually becomes a big struggle with that, and this circles back to pay a little bit, but managing payroll taxes.
Yeah, taxes. Government's got to get theirs, right? Like depending on where you live. And I guess that's something to, not to jump immediately back into that topic, but if I live in Idaho, I'm paying, you know, Idaho state tax based upon my wages and things of that nature. So yeah, like if you're the nomad, you know, generally I think most companies say, well, what's like your home base?
You have to have a physical address.
You have to have some sort of address.
That's an interesting point. As you know, I work for a financial services firm, so they do tax very well. And I remember last year, I mean, we didn't fly after March. March 7th, I think, was my last flight. And I remember I'd still spent enough days in Georgia that I had to file Georgia income taxes last year. And I'm like, huh? And, you know, again, we have systems for all that and it's all automated. Every time we work in a different office or we're traveling, you know, every time we do our time, that all gets factored in. It's very important for us because, you know, again, we're a financial services company. We do it right. But no, absolutely. If you're living that digital nomad life, like, you know, how are you, if your company is traditionally based in a place and you were based in that place and you can get away with it because you're remote, like how are they tracking that? Like how, and you know, it makes you wonder how quickly things like tax law will catch up with this kind of change in model. You know, who knows if it will. Like,
I think the government does a really good job of keeping tax laws up to date, more than they do like trademark laws and things of that nature.
Absolutely, right? They'll find a way to get their 2 cents.
Absolutely. So you know, I do have to just agree with you though, Ryan. Having worked remotely as well, last year was just it was nuts, right? And not indicative of what a typical work remote is. So. And Mark, you were saying, you know, this was, we're living in the post time now. I don't know that that's entirely true, but, you know, I think we're still going to see a lot of, need for education and growth on both the, employee and the employer side of what is remote working, especially for these roles that were traditionally never remote. There's still a lot to be learned. Hopefully a lot of growth that will be happening.
Well, are you planning on sending all your cohorts home for the final project week and seeing if they can solve it as a remote team?
You know, it's funny you said, I was going to close on this, but it might be interesting to see how younger students start to come in because they actually may have more years where they have had school as hybrid. And so I struggled in this realm and I think some of our students struggled in that realm because it was their first time in a virtual classroom. Will that change over time? I don't know. It remains to be seen. So we will go ahead and close out on that note. And we appreciate you listening to us. I do want to remind everybody, we are going to try and get in our next episode, a Q&A. So I'll be posting some links to submit Q&A questions. Ryan, I think you've got a setup on a GitHub for that.
We've got a template issue for questions.
Yep. So just go ahead and submit one of those issues to the GitHub podcast and we'll send out that link so you can let us know some of the questions you have and we'll try and get them addressed in the next episode. Until then, thank you for joining us.
That's a wrap for the dev team. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to subscribe to our channel for the latest content anywhere great podcasts are found. And remember, if you want clean code, wash your hands.